finished our previous study at the end of chapter 4 on the note that the world was populating and largely it had lost the knowledge of God. The number of people who maintained the knowledge of God as originally given was very small. It's the sort of thing that we read about in Romans chapter 1, for those of you who are familiar with Romans. In the first chapter of Romans, it tells us that although man was given the knowledge of God, he left it, and he replaced that knowledge of God with idolatry, immorality, polygamy, and all sorts of other evils. Now that's what happened here in these opening chapters of Genesis. And you find that the world was being populated by people who rejected God, Cain and all his descendants, and so they spread out. The number of people who maintained this knowledge of God seems to have been so small that by the time you get on to the era of Noah, Noah and his family were about the only ones that were still true believers in God. Now chapter 5 links the story of Adam with the story of Noah, and it traces through that very, very, very thin line of people who maintained their faith in God. The details here in chapter 5 are what we call a genealogy. That is, when you have a list of names, somebody was the father of somebody else and he was the father of somebody else, and so it goes on, lists and lists of names which appear to be very boring. Chapter 5 goes through those names from Adam to Noah. Now it lists only 10 names. It's what we call a selective genealogy or a stylized genealogy. It doesn't list every single person that was ever born to Adam or anybody else. It chooses out the 10 major people between Adam and Noah. There were probably many, many, many more generations than just 10. The Bible consistently uses the word father to mean ancestor. When it says so-and-so was the father of somebody, he could have been father or grandfather or great-grandfather or many times great-grandfather. Likewise, when it says he was the son, he could have been the actual son or the grandson or the great-great-great-great-grandson. There's no way that we can use this genealogy to measure the antiquity of man. All it's doing is choosing the 10 major names of the era and linking them together, showing how these people maintain their faith in God. The details it gives us, and we're not going to read this chapter because it's not terribly entertaining to read in a study like this, but the details are given of the age of the person when he gave birth to the person who in turn carried on the belief in God, the spiritual heir, if you like. And then that person in turn produced somebody else who was the second named person in the list. And then when he was a certain age, he produced somebody who in turn carried on the belief in God, and you follow down through his ancestor until you meet the third name in the list, and so it goes on. This idea of a stylized or selective genealogy was very common in the ancient times, and you find it repeatedly in the Bible. For example, it summarizes the period from Adam to Noah under 10 generations. Later on in chapter 11, it summarizes the era from Noah to Abraham, again under 10 generations. But you only have to read the material in that section to realize that there are very, very many more than just 10 generations involved. You have another one in Matthew chapter 1, the genealogy of Jesus Christ our Lord, where it's summarized under 3 sets of 14, from A to B 14, from B to C 14, and from C to D 14. But once again, if you look back into the Old Testament and trace the people whose names are mentioned there, you'll find that quite often a person is called the son of somebody when actually he was the great-great-great-grandson or something like that. Again, it's choosing the prominent people and linking them together so that the genealogy would be very easy to memorize. They didn't have computers, you couldn't press buttons in those days and throw it all up on a screen for you. You had to carry all the information around in your head. And this was a very simple way of memorizing the genealogies. Another point that should be noted in reading this chapter is these great lengths of time which people lived. We say, goodness me, living 600, 700, 900 years. And various attempts have been made to explain this. Some people have said it wasn't the age of an individual, but the age of the clan of that person through a certain era. Well, it won't take you long to be able to shoot that one down. Then there's another explanation which says it's not really that the years in those times were the same length as our years today. They may have been much shorter, so that the 900 years may not have been actually 900 years in our reckoning today. But once again, if you follow that through, you'll find you get into trouble. Some people just divide it all by 10, which brings it back to a much more manageable figure, of course. But it also creates problems when somebody gave birth to a certain person at the age of 75. You're down to a time of 7.5 years, which does create problems. There's no real alternative here. We simply take it as it is. And it's not unusual. Archaeological findings of the ancient world, which have nothing to do with the Bible, again testify to this longevity of life that was experienced by people in the Mesopotamian region that the Bible story is here connected with. I take them for the figures that they are, and that they apply to the individuals and not to the clans. God was overruling in this, and it was probably part of his plan, because going back to our key verse again in chapter 1, verses 27 and 28, where he says, "You must be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." And I don't think there's any doubt that these ancient types were pretty fruitful when it came to the job of producing children. They quickly multiplied, and if you live for several hundred years, there need be no doubt that you do your bit towards the fulfilling of that command. The story really serves to connect us with chapter 6, because in chapter 6 we find the same sort of thing recorded here as was recorded of Adam and Eve. That is, their presumption, their rebellion, their refusal to submit to God. It tells us in the first verse that when men began to multiply on the face of the ground and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife such of them as they chose. The sons of God and the daughters of men, what do they refer to? Some people would say the sons of God are those of the godly line that descended through Seth, and that the sons of men, or the daughters of men, are the ungodly line that was descended through Cain. I don't think that that really is the best explanation. Another explanation which strikes me as being more likely is that the sons of God is a reference to angelic beings, and I've given references in the book where frequently in the Old Testament you'll find that this is a title given to heavenly beings. And quite frequently in the book of Genesis, heavenly beings take on human form temporarily for various reasons. It appears that what happened here was that these heavenly beings, these sons of God, took upon themselves human form. These were fallen angels, if you like, and they collaborated with mankind to produce a race of people that they hoped would be physically indomitable, unconquerable, and would be immortal, would live forever. That is, would combine something of the timeless age of the spirit world with the physical characteristics of the material world that we are, and somehow live forever. It's really a repetition of what happened in Eden. You shall live forever. You shall be as God. And you find that as soon as man starts to develop, as soon as civilization starts to get going, man repeatedly wants to use his acquired wisdom or ability or whatever it is to make himself independent of God. And that is what is happening here. They want to be unconquerable and immortal. And so God says, I'm going to put you in your place in verse 3. You want to live forever? Well, my spirit shall not abide in you forever, because you're flesh. You want to be something better than flesh. You want to combine the spirit world with the flesh to produce something that is immortal. Well, you're not immortal, and my spirit does not abide in you forever. You are flesh, and just to prove the point, I'm going to cut your days down from the previous 800 or 900 years down to a respectable 120. And as you read the story on, you find that very quickly the lifespan of man, once you get out of the people mentioned in chapter 5, once you get out of that chapter, quickly it comes down to 175, down to 150, down to 125, and as you get on to the next book or so, it's down to the usual 70 or 80 years that we're more familiar with. Now, I think that is really the explanation of the story, but the lesson there for us is very plain of the presumption, the arrogance of man, and we're still seeing it today, that man will use whatever means he can to make himself independent of God so that he can live his own life, he can be as God and perpetuate his life in this independent state from God as long as he can and as forcefully as he can. And so God has to come in and chop him down to size. Well, we find that man did not reform, and in verses 5 and 6 God says, all right, judgment is inevitable. God sees the wickedness of man, it's great in the earth. And in verse 6, he's sorry he's made man, and he says, I'm going to wipe you out. Which brings us then to the story of Noah, through chapters 6, 7, and 8. Now the meaning of this is as follows. God is going to punish mankind for his sin. However, through the punishment, there is going to be salvation. So you have the story of Noah and the ark. God is going to preserve those who are faithful to him through this catastrophe. Out of these, he is then going to make a new beginning and repopulate the earth. The story, I think, is fairly well known to us, and I don't think there's any story in the Bible that's been more badly done by than this one, mainly going back to some of the storybooks we saw, which I think have given us all the wrong ideas. You know, the storybooks of a great big boat and two giraffes, and followed by two elephants, followed by two kangaroos, followed by two zebras, all going in one after the other like children holding hands marching into school. And I don't think that that is remotely like what ever happened, and certainly there's nothing in the Bible to indicate that we had this sort of parade ground with pairs marching in orderly fashion, and certainly not those rather interesting animals. For a start with, the Bible never says it was a boat. It wasn't a boat. It was an ark, and an ark is a box or a chest, as you probably well know. It was divided horizontally into divisions, decks if you like to call them that, and then it was divided vertically into compartments where the animals were housed. It had a roof on with a ventilation opening around the top, and the whole thing was designed to float. It was not a boat that was designed to sail, it was simply designed to float, so that when it rained it would float up on the waters, and when the waters receded it would settle back down again. It was simply a great big floating box. The idea, of course, of taking the animals in was to preserve a pair of each type so that they could reproduce themselves after the flood had subsided. Except that in chapter 7, verse 2, you notice in the case of some animals, seven pairs were taken. These were clean animals, and by clean animals it means animals which were able to be eaten or to be offered in sacrifice to God. And the reason for the extras taken in this case was, I would imagine, to provide, first of all, sacrifices when Noah came out of the ark, but going on from there to provide food in the period following the rehabilitation of the earth following the flood. The cause of the flood is quite clearly indicated in verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 70th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were open, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. We have, in other words, a combination of two things: heavy rain for 6 weeks, and some sort of eruption in the ocean floor, the fountains of the great deep, some sort of earthquake activity, I would imagine, in the earth's crust, which produced a tidal wave or some breaking up of the earth's crust, which caused the waters of the Persian Gulf to go rushing into the Mesopotamian Valley, where this story is set. And the combination of these two features created this abnormal flood. It rained for 6 weeks, then it stopped, and the ark continued to float for another 110 days until finally it came to rest. And it came to rest not on the top of Mount Ararat. The Bible doesn't say that. It says it came to rest in the Ararat ranges. It wasn't perched up on top of the highest peak. And the story makes it very clear as you move on that when Noah looked out of the top of the ark through that window under the roof overhang, he could see hills above him. So quite obviously it wasn't perched on the top of the highest mountain. It was somewhere in the Ararat ranges that it came to rest after 110 days. And then it was a further 7 months that they remained in the ark while the earth rehabilitated itself and was again a suitable habitation for man. Putting it all together, the total time Noah and his family and all the animals were in the ark was around about 1 year. It appears to me fairly obvious that the whole of this flood was something that was confined to the area of the Bible story, that is the Mesopotamian Valley, the whole of that region. And as we've come to expect, it's presented to us in the terms of a person who saw it, or who might have seen it. In fact, I think in this case it is from the person who saw it, Noah himself. He seems to have been the one who preserved the record for us. You have, for example, in chapter 8, verse 5, a reference to the fact that on the first day of the month the tops of the mountains were seen. So you see here how Noah is able to get a glimpse through the light and ventilation opening of the tops of the mountains somewhere out there. In other words, as far as he was concerned, the flood was something that was a total judgment on that world, and it covered the whole of the area which he knew about and about which he could get information. It was God's complete judgment on the ungodly world that we've been familiar with to this day. I don't at all think that this is a universal flood. I know there are traditions of floods in many countries, but that would be the most likely thing you get traditions of anywhere, of course, traditions of floods and earthquakes and the like. Floods are very common things. There's nothing in the Bible that requires us to say it was a universal flood and the whole earth was covered with several miles of water. I know that in this story it may say, for example, that the whole of the earth was flooded and the waters covered the face of the earth and expressions like that. But again, that's very typical right through the Bible. You can find dozens of references where it talks about the whole of the earth or the whole of the world, something, something, something. And it only really applies to the portion of the world that those people are concerned with. Now, I've given you a number of references in the book, but you could find actually dozens if you went through the scriptures. In fact, the most relevant to us at present, we're going to meet later on in the book of Genesis, where exactly the same expression here is used, all the earth, when there was the famine in Egypt, and all the earth went to buy grain from Joseph in Egypt. Well, it wasn't from the North Pole and from South America, it meant all the people in that area which the Bible was concerned about in that story. You can go through to Nebuchadnezzar, and his dominions were to the ends of the earth. And you look at the story of Nebuchadnezzar and you find actually that his kingdom was not all that big anyway. It covered an area about the size of Australia at the most. Or you can come through to the New Testament, the most prominent of all, in the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, where it says that people from every race and every nation under heaven were there in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. That's pretty all-embracing, isn't it, when you say every race and every nation under heaven? But when you read the names through, you find again that it was just from the few places round about which were the area of their concern. As far as they were concerned, that was the world as they knew it. And the total area of that world with which the Bible was concerned in its stories, that's the area that's concerned about in this story here in the flood. We don't have to get all hung up over this sort of thing. It's a perfectly natural way of expressing yourself in this type of story. And as I say, it's very common right through the Bible. Of course, if you're going to talk about a universal flood of several miles deep of water covering the whole of the earth, well then, I think we're all familiar with the sorts of problems that you have of polar bears walking from the North Pole and kangaroos jumping from Australia, all in pairs of course, somehow being drawn by some sort of magnetic force to this particular structure which Noah had, and then when it's all finished, jumping back to where they came from. And you have the problems of climate and of food and, you know, all sorts of frightfully difficult things. And I don't think the Christian has to be embarrassed over this, because really we don't have to try to explain that sort of thing, because the Bible is giving us the story in the context of the area of the world that is concerned. You also have the problem, of course, of trying to create enough water to cover the earth to the number of miles deep that is needed to cover all the mountains on the earth, which is more water than exists in the whole of the known universe, and you have to have special acts of creation to get it there. And then, of course, once you've got the whole globe covered with miles of water, how are you going to get rid of it? Well, then you have to have special acts of decreation, if I can use that word, to get rid of it all again. And so you have to start inventing miracles. Now, this is the thing that Christians are not to do. We are not simply to invent miracles every time we want to bail ourselves out of a problem. And we say, well, God could have done it. Well, of course, we know God could have done it. There's no argument about that. We're not arguing about what God could have done. God could turn this building into a pumpkin if he wanted to. There's no argument about what God can do. What we're arguing about is what God did do. And the Bible gives us no indication whatever that there were any special acts of creation or decreation. In fact, it tells us very clearly that what God was doing was announcing his judgment on the world of the Bible story as we know it to that date, and he was using the forces of nature to do it. It tells us very clearly there in chapter 7, verse 11, he used the forces of nature. He did not use a special act of creation. Creation's finished back in chapter 1 and 2. He used the rain, as it says, for 6 weeks, and then this convulsion in the floor of the ocean to create tidal wave or whatever it was, so that you had a combination of water falling down from above and water rushing in from the sea to produce the flood. And likewise, to get rid of it, he used the normal processes by which water is dispersed after a flood. As the atmospheric and geological elements return to normal, so in due course the flood subsides. And in verse 2 of chapter 8, verse 1, that God made a wind to blow across the earth, the water subsided. Verse 2, the fountains of the deep closed up, the windows of heavens were closed, the rain stopped, and the ocean settled back to where it was before. And so there it is. We all believe in miracles. I hope if we're Christians we have no hang-up over miracles and what God can do. But always, we must be careful when we're arguing about people. As soon as we get into a tight corner, we suddenly invent a miracle, when the Bible will say nothing about the miracle.
And we hypothesize this because it's a cheap way of getting out of a tight corner. We are not at liberty to invent miracles on God's behalf every time we want a good argument to knock somebody over with. The whole of this story is perfectly intelligible. It's entirely in keeping with the spirit of the Bible, with the teaching of the scriptures, with the theology of the Bible, and with the authority of the Bible to accept this as a flood of that particular area of the Bible's concern in the story to this time. Now, following that flood, we come to the end of chapter 8. They come out of the ark, and there's a new beginning. God promises that he won't destroy the earth by a flood again. There's reference here to a covenant. Just very briefly, what a covenant is. A covenant is an agreement between two people, where the two parties promise loyalty, and maybe there are blessings promised, or there are warnings or judgments announced if a person breaks the covenant. God makes a covenant with Noah, or rather with mankind through Noah, promising never to destroy the earth by a flood again. Every time you meet a covenant where God is a party to the covenant, it is never an equal sort of a thing where the two parties enter as equals. Always, God is the giver and man is the receiver. We can't negotiate anything with God. All we can do is accept what God does. And what God does, he does solely by his grace, his unmerited favor. We don't deserve it, but God takes the initiative and he does it. So his promise not to destroy the earth again is not because man is any better than he was before. In fact, we're going to find that man is just as bad as he was before. And what God is saying is that if I destroyed the whole of mankind by a flood every time there was this gross sin, well, there'd be a universal flood coming every year or so. What God is saying is, look, I've taught you this lesson. Let you realize that I won't destroy the earth this way again. Not because you're any better. You're just as bad as you ever were, but because I am gracious. You find that in chapter 8, verse 21. Noah offered a sacrifice, and God accepted the sacrifice and said, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, neither will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. So he says, I won't do this again, not because you're any better, because the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. People are always bad. So my promise not to destroy the earth is not because man has evolved upwards into some sort of higher spiritual realm, but simply because I am gracious, tolerant, and forbearing. He then goes on to say that he's going to let man live on his earth in verse 22, and he is going to continue to provide for them with the seasons. In other words, we live on God's earth solely by God's grace. We don't really deserve to live here because we rebel against God, we foul up his creation, we pollute the environment, we pollute the spiritual communion which we should have. God nevertheless forbears, he's tolerant, and he allows us to continue existing. He then gives to Noah in chapter 9 verse 1 the same sorts of commands as he gave to Adam. Be fruitful, multiply and fill the earth. We keep on going back to those two verses in chapter 1, don't we? And so we find now that the earth is to be repopulated. Man, however, is still in God's image. Man is still God's representative upon the earth, as we saw again back in chapter 1, verses 27 and 28. But that does not give him the right to do as he wishes. And so we have once again God imposing restrictions. This is following the same pattern as we had in the opening chapters where God gave his instructions to Adam and Eve, made in the image of God, representative God on this earth over his creation, but no absolute right to do as he likes. Therefore, although God gives man the foods on the earth to enjoy for himself, he has no right to treat life carelessly. He is not to adopt a cavalier fashion towards created things. In verse 3, God says, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, and as I gave you the green plants, so I give you everything. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. For your lifeblood I will surely require a reckoning. Of every beast I will require it, and of man. Of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So God is saying this, I am the owner of all life. All physical life, animal life, human life, I am the owner of it. The blood is symbol of that life. When you cut an animal's throat, its blood flows out, and so the blood, which is symbol of its life, now becomes symbol of its death. life is given. Shed blood, symbol of death. So he says, I'm going to allow you to take the life of animals to get food, but when you do so, you must pour the blood out as a sacrificial offering to me. You are not to take it to yourself, because it symbolizes the animal's life. So by your act of pouring out the blood and not using it for your own benefit, you are acknowledging the fact that I am the owner of that life, and that you are taking the life of that animal only by my permission. If, however, you take the life of a person, murder him, without my permission, then, he says, that is a more serious crime, because you are not only taking the life which I have created, but you are taking the life of something which was made in my image. Therefore, the person who murders another person, because he has destroyed the life of somebody who was made in my image, that person is no longer fit to enjoy further my gift of life. And so that person's life is forfeit. He must be executed for the crime he has committed. Now, there's some very important principles there. Next time you're coming up with some discussion on the Christian attitude to the conservation of wildlife, you may find that this chapter has something to say. And next time you come up with a discussion on whether it's right to have capital punishment for offences such as willful murder, you may also care to look at these verses and consider whether the Bible has something to say there. We move on then to follow the story of Noah and his sons through as the earth is now repopulated. There's a story here which happened quite some years later when Noah was now a lot older than he was previously. His sons and daughters now had children who themselves were grown up. So Noah had grandchildren, and for all we know he may have had great grandchildren as well. And on one occasion Noah got drunk. He let himself go and he was lying down there in the nude. It was a bit of a disgraceful thing to say the least. And when his sons found out about it, two of them, Japheth the oldest and Shem the next one, they were shocked and they tried to cover up the disgrace of their father. But the other son, the youngest one, Ham, he somehow decided he'd make some capital out of it. And he and his son, Canaan, who was an adult by this time, we don't know the exact nature of their offence. You can assume what you like. But whatever it was shocking. And because of this, God announced his judgment upon them. The other two sons, who were ashamed of what their father did and tried to shelter him from the disgrace which might follow, God commended them for their action. But the other two, who stooped to these low depths to carry out their dastardly deed, whatever it was, God announced his judgment upon them. He announced his judgment upon Ham, not upon all of Ham's descendants, but upon all of Ham's descendants through that particular son, Canaan. And when you come to the end of chapter 9, you'll find it there in verses 24 to the end. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan." Canaan actually was his grandson. "A slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed by the Lord, my God, be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." If I can just take you forward a little in the story here, Shem was to be the father of the Israelite people. We're going to see in a moment how Shem had a son and a son and a son and a son and a son, and eventually you come down to Abraham. Now Shem had, by this time, countless thousands of descendants. And all of these descendants are called Shemites, or Semites if you like. And one of these was Abraham. And Abraham, of course, had a number of sons, and one of them was Isaac. And Isaac had sons, and one of them was Jacob. And then through Jacob, the nation Israel developed. So they are descended from Shem. And although, strictly speaking, all the descendants of Shem are Shemites, or Semites, today we normally refer to the Israelite people in particular as the Semites. Well, the Israelite people came from Shem. The people who lived in Canaan and who were later conquered by Israel when Israel went in under Joshua and conquered Canaan, these people were descendants of Ham through Canaan. The land of Canaan took its name from the descendants of Canaan who lived there. Now Canaan is going to serve Shem. And that happened when the Israelites later under Joshua conquered Canaan, and then those who were not destroyed became servants of Israel. And you get those stories in Joshua, Judges, Samuel and Kings. And then you find in verse 27 that Japheth shall dwell in the tents of Shem. The descendants of Japheth, after the flood, as they migrated, they moved up into northern Mesopotamia and across into Asia Minor and even spilled over into Greece. They are to dwell in the tents of Shem. That is, they are to come into the blessings of Shem. That was fulfilled in the New Testament times, when you find that the New Testament story takes us through that area and shows us how the people who came into the Christian church were largely from these areas of Asia Minor. And they now became the people of God, which previously, of course, had been largely Jewish. So these people now became fellow heirs with those Jews, and they became the true spiritual descendants of Abraham. And so that's how those prophecies, I believe, were fulfilled. Japheth now coming into the blessings of Shem, Canaan, on the other hand, becoming a servant of Shem. We come now to chapter 10, which is another of these genealogies. This chapter must have been written hundreds of years later than the flood, when the earth had been repopulated by the descendants of Japheth, Ham, and Shem. And what this chapter does is to tell us how, over the ensuing centuries, these people migrated to different parts, set up their settlements, and as they got their settlements going, so they spread out. Some of them became nomads, and they wandered over all the different parts of the world then. If you look at chapter 10, the first verse tells us that these are the generations or the descendants of Noah, and the three of them are Shem, Ham, and Japheth. In verse 2, it lists the descendants of Japheth. In verse 6, the descendants of Ham, with special reference in verse 15 to Canaan. And then in verse 21, it lists the descendants of Shem. I'm not going to go through all those names there, but in broad terms, remember again, the centre of our story is the Mesopotamian Valley, the Persian Gulf, and then the Tigris River, the Euphrates River, ancient Babylonia. All the Bible story to this date has been set there in the Mesopotamian Valley. The Tower of Babel is there, the Garden of Eden, the Tigris River, Euphrates River, Ur of the Chaldees, Mount Ararat. All these stories are there. Now, after the flood, Japheth and his descendants moved through parts of Mesopotamia, and then they spilled across into Asia Minor and even into Greece. And you find that if you're keen enough to study the names that are listed in verses 2 to 5. The descendants of Ham in verses 6 to 20 also inhabited Mesopotamia. They came down through the land of Canaan, which was named after one of the descendants of Ham, and even down into Egypt and around this part of the Red Sea. And then the third section, verses 21 to the end, the descendants of Shem also occupied Mesopotamia, and then they migrated down through Arabia and some of these other areas east of the Dead Sea down there. So that more or less gives you the picture of the names mentioned there in chapter 10. We'll put that on again later on if somebody wants to copy it. One or two points, as you read through chapter 10, you'll find that sometimes the same name occurs in the list of Ham, for example, and in the list of Shem. And you scratch your head and you say, what's going on here? Are they descended from one or the other? Well, actually, they could be descended from both, because you can think yourself of how a great-great-great-grandson of Ham may have married a great-great-great-granddaughter of Shem, which means that their descendants would be descended from both Ham and from Shem. So that's one of the reasons why the names occur in two of the lists. And another thing is that people did have the same name, just like we have lots of Johns and Marys today. So it was in Bible times. In fact, if you go back to chapter 5, you'll find Lamech and Enoch and people mentioned there, the same names as you find mentioned back in the descendants of Cain in chapter 4. But they're different people. It's just a fluke that they have the same name. So don't get thrown by those sorts of things when you meet them. These people, as they migrated, became the founders of various groups. And in chapter 10, verse 5, it summarizes that by saying, in the second sentence, these are the sons of Japheth in their lands, each with his own language, by their families, in their nations. And so you have the various regions, cultures, languages, and so on developing in this time following the flood. And the names of the nations very often came from the names of the founding fathers who settled with their families and clans in the different areas. Well, that's a fairly boring section, really, chapters 10 and through chapter 11, where you again have various descendants. In fact, chapter 11, before we leave these genealogies, chapter 11 has 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. And this will show us how Abraham was descended from Shem. If you look at verse 10, Shem was the father of Arpachshad. In verse 12, Arpachshad was the father of Shelah. Verse 14, Shelah the father of Eber, and that man Eber is the man from whom the word Hebrew comes. And so the Israelites are known as Semites because they're descended from Shem. They're known as Hebrews because they're descended from Eber. and they're known as Israelites because they were descended from Israel, which is another name for Jacob. Verse 16, Eber became the father of Peleg. Verse 18, Peleg the father of Reu. Verse 20, Reu the father of Serug. Verse 22, Serug the father of Nahor. Verse 24, Nahor the father of Terah. And 26, Terah the father of Abram. So that gives us connection between Noah and Abram. Now before we finish off, those first few verses of chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. This area of Babel, or ancient Babylonia, was a settlement that had been established by a man called Nimrod in the place called Shinar, there again in the Mesopotamian region. We find that these people demonstrate the same anti-God spirit that we've seen previously. You shall be as gods. Want to be independent of God, want to make a name for yourself, want to determine good and evil, want to be the Lord of the universe. We saw it in Eden. We saw it in Cain and his descendants. We saw it in Lamech and the bravado which he displayed. We saw it in the story of chapter 6 of the sons of God and the daughters of men. We saw it in the events that produced the flood. We see it again here. As soon as men get together, mankind progresses, civilization develops, societies become more stable, man increases in his knowledge and his abilities, and almost every time he will use these things to fortify himself, to develop his own self-sufficient way of life, always at the expense of God. And that's what happens here. In verse 4, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. Don't take that literally again. That simply means a skyscraper. We don't take it literally when somebody talks about a skyscraper. These people weren't stupid enough to think that somehow they could build something that penetrated into the heaven where God lives. It was something that went up very high, like an ancient ziggurat. It was a fortification installation, or maybe even a temple. But whatever it was, as far as they were concerned, it was a symbol of their advanced civilization. So let us build this tower, which is a symbol of our achievement, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. You see that anti-God spirit? That arrogance of man, which is within his nature, and it's within our natures, wanting again to exalt ourselves in the face of God and to establish our own independence so that we can do our thing and we can forget about God. Well, whatever they thought it was, symbol of their development, symbol of their civilization, symbol of their great society or their achievements, God saw it as a symbol of man's arrogance, of man's rebellion. Sometimes we might question the achievements of man in this age. Sometimes we can use these things, and I would imagine that on the whole mankind uses these things arrogantly to praise himself and to slowly but surely think that he can squeeze God right out of his life. That's the temptation that you and I are facing. The same temptation which motivated these people here at the building of the Tower of Babel. Well, God won't tolerate it. God says we'll go down there and we'll smash this unholy unity decisively. And so you have the destruction of the tower and the confusion of the people which results. Well, there's been something there of a mixed bag this morning. Some parts have been a bit dead and boring in there with the various genealogies. Don't blame me, I didn't write the book of Genesis. All I'm trying to do is to throw a few rays of light here and there so that we might get the general drift of what's happening. What I want to do next time is go from chapter 12 through to chapter 23, which is quite a bit. That is the story of Abraham.